Mr. Sykes, before you get started, I just want to ask your opposing counsel, if you have, I see there are three counsel present. Have you decided how you're going to divide your time?
Yes, Your Honor. I will keep the client chair. If there are questions about the corporate practice of medicine doctrine, Mr. Epstein will field those questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we're ready to hear your argument now.
Well, thank you. May it please the court, I'm Ben Sachs. I'm representing the plaintiff appellant in this case, Amber Fitzpatrick, and forgive me in advance if I use the familiar on occasion. Central to this case are questions of Dr. Handler's employment, if any, as of a particular date, March 10 of 2000. The trial court determined that Dr. Handler, as a matter of law, was a public employee as of that date, and that's where I'm going to begin. I'm going to begin because normally, as the court knows, in questions of employment and scope of employment are questions that usually involve factual issues to be determined by a fact finder. And in fact, the restatement of agency, which has been adopted in Colorado on issues of employment, employment status, lists a number of different factors, non-exhaustive factors, that go into the determination of whether a person is an employee or a servant agent, as sometimes it's referred, of another. Now, when the facts are undisputed, then the trial court can certainly decide the matter as a matter of law under 56H. But this is certainly not that sort of case. And that's where I'd like to begin. Because the trial court in this case was confronted with only documentary evidence and rejected the plaintiff's request and affidavits supporting a request for additional discovery, or actually any discovery under 56F that was signed by Jim Leventhal, specifying the reasons why specific discovery were needed in order to establish the existence of a tribal issue of material fact.
So I'm a little perplexed by the procedural. Normally, this sort of determination would be made in the course of a Trinity hearing. Is that correct?
Well, questions related to the status of a putative public employee might be addressed in the context of a Trinity hearing. Don't forget that there are questions about whether Dr. Handler, as of this particular date of the surgery, was an employee at all, or whether he was an employee of the university or the School of Medicine, or he might have been an employee of UPI, or he may have been an employee of another entity. So, there are all those logical possibilities. So certainly questions relating to his status as a private employee, if at all, wouldn't be resolvable in a Trinity hearing. Those could be resolved in the context of a Rule 56 motion. And in fact, I think that questions about compliance with the GIA certainly are proper subject matter for a Trinity hearing, but and I certainly agree with you that questions about his status as a public employee could have been addressed in a Trinity evidentiary hearing, but that's not the way that this court addressed it. And in fact, the court refused to allow even limited discovery by the plaintiff as to Dr. Handler's status as an employee, if indeed he was an employee at all. So this court reviews that determination by the trial court de novo.
Why do we review de novo? I'm so confused. As to Dr. Handler, the court, though purporting to operate under 56H, the cases say this is a 12B1 determination. The court has to make a finding. We don't let juries make a finding as to who a public employee is. The court makes the finding, and that is a factual finding. So why do we review the factual finding de novo?
Because Judge Whitney didn't make that factual determination in the context of a Trinity hearing or a 12B1 motion. Judge McGee made the determination, that was the first judge, in the context of a Rule 56 motion for partial summary judgment and in the context of UPI's motion for determination of a question of law. So those determinations were made not in the context of a 12B1 motion at all. They were made in the context of Rule 56.
But regardless of the number of rules you want to throw out there, what in fact happened was the court reviewed the evidence on the question and made a finding. And that is a factual finding. It is a question of fact.
Well, I agree with you that whether or not he was a public employee is certainly a question of fact.
And one that the court must make, must not defer to a jury, the court must make it.
Well, you're begging the question of whether or not he was a public employee. You're assuming he was a public employee.
No, I'm not. But the court must resolve that question to determine whether the CGIA applies. We don't try the case, let the jury decide whether the person was a public employee, and then if the jury so determines, apply immunity. We do it up front. The judge makes the call. The judge here made the call.
Well, the judge McGee made the call, and he didn't make it in the context of a 12B1 motion. None had been filed, and no one briefed or argued the point that it ought to be addressed in the context of a 12B1 motion or a Trinity hearing.
But we have to look at the substance of what happened. The substance of what happened is evidence was presented on the point by both sides, and the judge made a factual determination as to his employment.
He determined that there was no genuine dispute based on documentary evidence that the parties had submitted. And I would say that in this court's review, it's in as good a position as both of the judges in the trial court to determine whether or not there is a factual dispute as to his employment status that warranted a full-blown evidentiary hearing, or whether or not that was properly resolvable under Rule 56, as the trial court elected to do.
Are we in as good a position simply because this is all documentary evidence?
Yes.
All right, but I didn't see any citations of authority in the brief to that effect.
Well,
it sounds like kind of a new argument to me.
It's not a new argument. This just goes to the nature of your review. I think that it's beyond question. Our contention is that it's de novo review because of the trial court's determinations under Rule 56. And
de novo review precisely of what? Whether there's a genuine issue of material fact?
Yes, and whether or not Dr. Handler is entitled to a determination as a matter of law that he is a public employee for purposes of the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act.
Mr. Sachs, am I correct in recalling that in Trinity the Supreme Court said that the correct procedure for determining immunity under the Governmental Immunity Act was 12B1 and not summary judgment?
Yes, but for determination of, you know, a public employee's claim status, that's normally the process. And it may be an evidentiary hearing or it may not be an evidentiary hearing, depending on whether or not there are disputed facts and documents.
So what I understand Judge Jones to be suggesting is that if the 56H motions here for determination of law really addressed at bottom a question of immunity under the Governmental Immunity Act, that they should be treated as if they were a 12B1 determination.
Well,
and Judge Jones can correct me if I'm misapprehending what he's saying.
That puts it better than I did.
So,
well, I understand, and you know, our position is different. Our position is that it's not only how it was decided, but there were issues. One of the ways you get to whether someone is a public employee is by deciding what they aren't. So our contention throughout was that Dr. Handler was in fact an employee, but he was a private employee. He was an employee of University Physicians Incorporated, a group practice set up under Colorado law. So if he was a private employee, then there's no question of subject matter jurisdiction, right? Under the Hennessy case, you know, he's an employee of a private corporation, and therefore he's not entitled to the protection of the Governmental Immunity Act. And again, the focus is not generically, was he a public employee? We're focusing on a particular date. March 10, 2000. And we have documents. We have the only document evidencing that he was a member of the faculty of the School of Medicine is a document that is dated and signed after the date of the surgery in question. So, you know, it was for no other reason than that, plaintiff should have been allowed an evidentiary hearing and limited discovery. So, all right. So, our contention here is that there was a genuine issue of material fact based on the documentary evidence alone as to Dr. Handler's status as a public employee on March 10, 2000. And looking at the documents, it's evident that there was a question of who, if anyone, had the right to control the details of his performance, which is the central question in determining employment status. So the documents, which include the member practice agreement, which was in effect prior to the surgery, and the faculty appointment agreement, faculty contract, which was signed after after the day of the surgery, don't answer the question of who had the right or the authority to control the details of Dr. Handler's performance. So certainly additional discovery would have been warranted. And our contention is it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court not to have allowed that discovery. And by the way, this entire house of cards collapses if there is a factual question as to Dr. Handler's status as a public employee on March 10, 2000. It's not for this court to decide it, it's a question of law. If there's a factual question, it either has to be decided on summary judgment or in the context of a 12B1 motion. So, all right. I wanted to reserve some time, but I'm going to take a little bit of time on what I think is the most atrocious and critical aspect of this case. And that has to do with notice of claim under the Governmental Immunity Act. And we're dealing here with a 12-year-old, Amber Fitzpatrick, who wakes up from surgery to find that she is paralyzed. And the contention of the defendants is that that was notice, that's exactly the point, or shortly thereafter, when Amber Fitzpatrick knew that she had been injured. But this is certainly a misconstruction of the term injury in the Governmental Immunity Act. Injury is a concept that is not the same as knowledge that you've been paralyzed or that you've had an unsuccessful outcome of surgery. That's not it at all. It is knowledge that you have been injured through a wrongful act, that it's a wrongful injury. It's the concept of injury in the Governmental Immunity Act is a legal injury. It's not factual. So the court applied the incorrect standard in saying, well, she must have known that she was permanently paralyzed when she woke up from surgery. That wasn't the issue. The issue was, when did she or when would a reasonable 12-year-old under her same circumstances have known that she was wrongfully injured, that it was an iatrogenic harm? So I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Mr. Sachs, I'm sorry, but I have to ask you a question relating to your last statement. I want to quote from Gallagher. Discovery of the injury, and this is a Colorado Supreme Court case that we're bound by, discovery of the injury in this context only requires that the claimant realize there is some injury. The person need not have determined the cause of the injury, end quote. That seems to be directly contrary to what you just said.
Well, okay, two elements of accrual. Knowledge of an injury, discovery of an injury, and discovery of its cause. That's the discovery rule that's codified in the statute of limitations.
This is not a statute of limitations.
Exactly.
But they're talking about the CGIA.
But you can't conflate the concept of causation in the accrual statute with the concept of an injury in the GIA. You know, whether or not you have knowledge of the cause of an injury isn't the same thing as understanding and conceptualizing that you have suffered a legal injury, which the discovery of which triggers your time to file a notice of claim.
Mr. Sachs, can you give us your best authority? What is the best site for us to
that would evidence that last proposition.
The Trinity.
Trinity itself. Thank you.
Wrongful act. Yeah. I'm going to reserve the remaining 36 seconds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs.
Excuse me. May it please court and counsel, I'm Ron Nemiro of the firm Kennedy and Childs, 15178, here on behalf of the appellee, Dr. Michael Handler, MD. I propose to organize my presentation in much the same way that Mr. Sachs did. The key issue here is whether Dr. Handler, as a member of the CU School of Medicine faculty and as a member of UPI, is protected by the Governmental Immunity Act, which I'll refer to as the Act. That's the key issue here, and I'll devote most of my time to that. It is an ancillary issue as to whether it's clear error for the trial court to determine that Ms. Fitzpatrick's notice was late under the Act, when the Act requires notice within 180 days of knowledge of the injury, and notice here was given more than 3 years later.
Ancillary because if he's a public employee, he's simply immune?
Well, it's ancillary because then that's a fact finding after a Trinity hearing, and this court would have to defer to that, to the trial court in that respect. That's a foregone conclusion, it seems to me, because the record is so replete with evidence to support the court's conclusion. The record is also replete with evidence to support the trial court's conclusion regarding his employment status. I think the court is correct that the analysis, however the trial court characterized it, is an analysis that's done under 12b1 because it's jurisdictional under the Governmental Immunity Act.
It should be done under 12b1. I think you and I at least agree on that. But here, it's unusual in the sense that even assuming 12b1 had been invoked, we only have documents. Okay, we don't have an evidentiary hearing per se. We don't have live testimony and that sort of thing like we normally do. And aren't we in as good a position when we're just talking about looking at documentary evidence as the trial court? And if we are in as good a position, don't we review that de novo?
I think that's true.
Okay.
I think it's primarily documentary evidence.
No, it's entirely documentary.
It's entirely documentary evidence. Okay. The documents are very persuasive.
Okay.
The documents, and I agree it's de novo.
Okay.
On those grounds. I think, however, that the importance of it being decided under 12b1 is that the plaintiff does not get the benefit of inferences. It's de novo review of the trial court as a fact finder. So the Rule 56 analysis, that if there's a dispute in the facts, ties to the runner, doesn't apply here. It is the trial court as fact finder. And the documents here are compelling.
Mr. Nemiro, let me ask you a question or two about this. The trial court here ruled on this issue on the basis of Rule 56H, so it didn't make findings of fact.
It ruled at first it ruled on the basis of 56H, but as the case progressed, as it went to a Trinity hearing, that was taken as a given. The plaintiff could have always raised this issue at the Trinity hearing and opted not to for whatever reason.
Well, it had already been decided.
It had already been decided, but it could also have been disputed. He could have raised a Trinity argument at the 56H point, too. Even though it had been decided, it had been decided by the same court. And the law of the case doesn't prevent the court from revisiting it. But the plaintiff decided not to raise that issue.
You're saying that the plaintiff elected not to request a Trinity hearing on the 56H motion.
Or a Trinity hearing that was held to raise that issue. The plaintiff had two options.
Well, and my other question, Mr. Nemiro, is this. Mr. Sachs was just telling us that his concern is that the trial court didn't allow discovery, which, had it been afforded, would have provided an opportunity, presumably, to obtain additional information. So whether we're reviewing documents or not, how does that square with the arguments that the plaintiffs were trying to obtain more discovery?
Recall the posture that this came to the trial court in. Both UPI and Dr. Handler moved to have, as a question of law, have it determined that Dr. Handler was a public employee. The evidence that they submitted was the letter of offer and acceptance and the contract that came from the offer and acceptance.
Counsel, let me just focus right there on a second, for a second. Am I correct in understanding that offer and acceptance and the contract all post-dated the surgery?
No.
Okay.
The offer and acceptance was made in December of 99. The contract required the ratification of the Board of Regents, and that was done later in March of 2000.
Okay.
The contract that requires ratification is still binding. And we cited Murray on contracts for that in the court below, and that wasn't argued. The plaintiff hasn't disputed that. So the documentary evidence that was presented was compelling. There was essentially an employment contract, an offer, and an acceptance. The documentary evidence that the plaintiff provided to create an issue of fact was not compelling. That is the UPI membership agreement. The UPI membership agreement, by its terms, first, it presupposes that there is an employment agreement between Dr. Handler and the university. Because by its terms, it doesn't kick in unless there's an employment contract. Every document that the plaintiff cited, every document the plaintiff submitted, actually, when read as a whole, supports the notion that there was an employment contract between the university and Dr. Handler. And I speak of Dr. Handler, but the issue here is much broader than that. Every university physician is a member of UPI. The record on appeal shows that. If plaintiff is successful in this argument, plaintiff will have established that the Governmental Immunity Act does not apply to any university physician. This is an audacious argument, and it's not supported by plaintiff's documentation. As I noted, the membership agreement, whatever it's called, the preamble of that says that it does not modify, abrogate, or change the employment relationship between Dr. Handler and the university. The last, I think it's section 6, says that under no circumstance, let me refer to my notes. I don't have a committed to memory yet. I will probably by the time this case is over.
While you're looking at that, counsel, just think about this. Are there any members of UPI that are not members of the university faculty?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I know that there aren't members of the university faculty who are not members of the UPI.
Got it.
At least that's what the record shows. The member practice agreement says in paragraph 6, the member recognizes that he/she is acting as an agent of the university when participating in approved programs of the School of Medicine and shall be covered by the university's malpractice insurance program. There is no way to read that document as a whole and conclude that UPI is the employer for Dr. Handler or any other doctor. The plaintiff speaks of the right to control as being determinative of whether the doctor is a public employee under the Governmental Immunity Act. That's not quite right. A public employee is defined in a number of ways under the Act. And the way that matters for this case is as follows. Public employee includes, and I'm quoting from 103.4b of the Act, any healthcare practitioner employed by a public entity, except for any healthcare practitioner who is employed on less than a full-time basis by a public entity and who additionally has an independent or other healthcare practice. There is no evidence, none, that Dr. Handler was less than a full-time employee. There is no evidence, none, that he had an independent or other healthcare practice.
So as long as the record shows that Dr. Handler was a full-time employee, then we don't have to look to the issues of control. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the issues of control, as Mr. Sachs pointed out, don't sit comfortably on doctors, since doctors are charged with using their own judgment to practice medicine, and hospitals can't control doctors. That's why this other definition under the Act is so important in this case. But it's true that if he is a public employee, if he is an employee of the university, then it doesn't matter if he is associated with University Physicians, Inc., because the Act protects employees of public entities. There is nothing in the act that suggests if he's a member of a billing, if he uses a billing service like UPI, it is exempt from the protection of the act. Nor would it make any sense. F. Scott Fitzgerald has said that it's the mark of a first-rate mind to hold at once two contradictory ideas. And if that's the case, then plaintiff's arguments in this respect are first-rate. Because at one and the same time, they're arguing that the UPI contract is evidence that he was an employment of the university, and yet that contract presupposes an employment relationship. They're arguing that he wasn't an employee of the university, and yet they also argue that he failed to get the informed consent of Ms. Fitzpatrick because he didn't tell them he was an employee of the university. It's one thing to argue in the alternative, it's another to get so contorted that you end up consuming yourself. And that's where that argument goes. The other documents that the plaintiff relies on to establish an employment relationship between UPI and Dr. Handler don't do anything of the sort. Plaintiff ends up reading them a bit like a ransom note, cutting out the parts that they like and pasting them together to make a message that advances their case. The amended and restated bylaws the plaintiff refers to support the notion that Dr. Handler was an employee of the university. They point out that UPI was organized pursuant to 2320 and 114. And under that statute, the university may hire a billing agent, which is what UPI is. Article 1, Section 2C of the bylaws point out that UPI is not permitted to practice medicine. That provision can't coexist with plaintiff's interpretation of it. Article 3 of the bylaws say that members and associated members have to already be faculty members before they can be members of UPI. That's a point that I've made before here. And lastly, Article 21, Section 3 says that the bylaws are not to be interpreted in a way that waives the Governmental Immunity Act. And yet that's exactly the way that plaintiff would read those bylaws. Similarly, the operating agreement, the 94-95 operating agreement, and the articles of incorporation say the same things. They relegate UPI to the role of a billing and disbursement agent, and they make membership in the UPI contingent upon being an employee, a member of the faculty of the School of Medicine of the University of Colorado. As to the issue of notice, the record is, as I said, replete with support for the trial court's conclusions.
Let's get to the legal issue, though. That's the one that Mr. Sachs was focusing on, not the factual finding of the trial court, but the legal issue of what the plaintiff has to know before this 180-day period is triggered. According to Mr. Sachs, the plaintiff has to know not merely that she is injured, but that she is injured by virtue of the wrongful conduct of somebody. How do you respond to that?
In two ways. First, I think Gallagher discloses of that. The language from Gallagher that this court cited says that the plaintiff does not need to know the cause. But even if it were, as plaintiff says, by the time that she woke up from surgery, she knew sadly of her injuries and that they could be claimed in tort. One of her claims, for example, is a lack of informed consent. And that claim is that she wasn't warned of the risks. By the time she awoke from surgery, sadly, she knew the risks. Another claim is that in her affidavit, she said that she thought that the tumor had been successfully resected and that her paralysis was a result of the successful resection of the tumor. She testified at the Trinity hearing that in May of 2000, she knew the tumor had not been resected. So those facts establish that she knew or should have known that she was wrongfully injured, that she could support relief in tort. And then there's also the res ipsa loquitur claim, which isn't a recognized claim, but even so, the whole point of it is that the negligence is such that it doesn't require expert testimony to explain. That's a claim in each one of the four iterations of her complaint. All of those things suggest that not only did she know she was injured, she knew she was injured in such a way as to satisfy the standards proposed by the plaintiff. But I don't think those are the standards required by Colorado law. And I think Gallagher supports that. If there are no further questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Nimro.
Thank you.
I'll just take my remaining 34 seconds to read to you from Gallagher versus Board of Trustees, page 391, 54 P3rd at 391. For purposes of the CGIA, the notice period is triggered when a claimant has only discovered that he or she has been wrongfully injured. There was a significant factual dispute in this case, which the court didn't reach because it misconstrued the term injury for purposes of the GIA. The court thought that it could completely divorce the concept of causation without inquiring as to when Amber knew that she, as a 12-year-old, with the understanding of a 12-year-old, that she had been wrongfully injured. The court didn't reach that determination because it applied the wrong standard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs. Thank you again, Mr. Nimro and Mr. Epstein. We appreciate your arguments and your presence this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.